Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast series on the New Books Network. This podcast is for people who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Ahmed Mazmi from Princeton University. Today, I'm here to talk to Professor Natalie Boots, the author of the award-winning book, Islands of Heritage, Conservation and Transformation in Yemen, published by Stanford University Press in 2018, and recipient of the MES Book Award in 2019, which is sponsored by the American Anthropological Association Middle East Section. Natalie Boots is an assistant professor of anthropology at New York University, Abu Dhabi. By discussing this book, we will explore an often overlooked part of the Indian Ocean world, that of the island of Socotra, between the Arabian Peninsula and the Horn of Africa. It is the largest island of Yemen's Socotra Archipelago, and one of the most uniquely diverse among the most marginalized regions of Yemen. It was promoted recently for its outstanding global value as a UNESCO Natural World Heritage Site. Islands of Heritage share Socotran's stories to offer the first exploration of environmental conservation, heritage production, and development in an Arab state. Speaking from Vermont, welcome Natalie to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your book today.
Thank you so much, Ahmed. Thanks for having me, and it's really a pleasure to be on this podcast.
Can you please start us off by saying a few words about yourself, that where did you grow up, where you went to school, how you became interested in your field of study?
Sure. So I grew up both in the Netherlands for a couple of years, and then I moved to New Jersey. And I got a BA in history at the University of Pennsylvania and ended up going to graduate school at Princeton University, so near where I'd grown up. When I studied in college, I was a history major, interested in Eastern Europe primarily. And so I did a lot of travel in that area, but I had taken one introductory anthropology course, but had not thought about that as something that I would end up pursuing. And then after college, I ended up traveling for 3 years. I actually biked from Prague to the border of South Africa, and spent two of those 3 years were traveling through the Middle East, from East Africa, Eastern Europe, through Turkey, and then down East Africa. And then and in a year in the middle, I worked for the International Rescue Committee in a Rwandan refugee camp in Tanzania. So I say all that because that's when I became interested in working on refugees or with refugees. But I also shifted my interest from Eastern Europe to the Middle East and East Africa, as well as wanting to learn Arabic, and also became very interested in cultural anthropology because I'd spent so much time during that trip staying with different families along the way and really kind of wanting to think about how to write about things like cultural diversity and difference. So this was kind of a formative experience. And I came back from that, spent a couple years working, and then went to graduate school in anthropology and then shifted towards trying to study Arabic.
Fascinating. Who did you work with? Did you have any mentors?
Oh yeah. So Princeton is a a powerhouse of a department, and I it's although it's relatively small. So because of that, I actually kind of count everybody who was faculty there at Princeton at the time as my mentors. But I worked especially closely with my advisor, of course, Carolyn Rouse, who's still there and has been inspiring all these years. And also my dissertation committee, James Boone, Carol Greenhouse, and Larry Rosen, many of whom I had the pleasure of seeing this past year when I was a fellow at Princeton and just from this in 2019 to 2020. So and all of them are such profound, inspiring thinkers and individuals that often when I'm writing articles today or chapters, I still find myself thinking back to you know, the kind of the ways that people like Carol and Jim and Larry and Carolyn would think and present their ideas and the kind of energies and enthusiasms they had for their own projects.
Great. The book is really rich, and I would like to start talking about it. So your earlier work was on deportation, which you published in your co-edited volume with Nicholas Di Genova, entitled The Deportation Regime, Sovereignty, Space, and the Freedom of Movement, published in 2010 by Duke University Press. So how that project on deportation led to your recent book on Islands of Heritage? How did that book idea develop? What was the research process like? And if you can share the writing experience.
Sure. Yeah, those seem on the outset like two very different kinds of projects. And in some ways they are, but they kind of developed. I had a connection when I made that shift. So I began studying Arabic in Yemen in 1999. And that's when I first heard about Socotra, but it was very difficult to visit there because during the monsoon season occurs in the summers, which is when I was going to Sana'a to study Arabic. And it seemed like a very difficult time to go. And in fact, actually, as I'll probably talk about a little bit more later, Socotra was cut off. People could not reach Socotra by dhow, by sea, until 1990, during those monsoon periods, because the seas are too rough and there are no natural harbors. And it was only in 1999 that the airstrip was lengthened so that you could have flights going year round. So when I first heard about Socotra, it did sound like this place that was somehow, you know, quite remote and cut off from the mainland. And so I knew about it, but I was actually my first interest was in working on refugees, return migrants, and deportees in Yemen and the Horn of Africa. And so I'd begun this project on, in fact, I was actually going to Somalia to meet, to kind of think about the connection between Somalia and Yemen, because I had been talking to a lot of Somali refugees in Yemen. And that's where I met people who'd been deported from the United States, which is what led to that project. So it kind of started in Yemen, brought me to Somaliland. And then I thought I would continue doing work in either Somaliland or on the coast of Yemen with these deportees and return migrants and refugees all living in the same area. But when I went to Yemen for a longer period to start that work, it was in 2003. And this was right at the time of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And so we were actually prohibited from leaving Sana'a, from leaving the capital, because the U.S. embassy, but also the Yemeni government, was afraid of protests and a backlash against U.S. citizens. And so I felt a little bit stuck in Sana'a, but also thinking that I couldn't get to Hodeidah or the Red Sea area at that time. And the one place it seemed that it was permissible to travel, that we could get travel permissions to go to, was Socotra, because it again, there was the sense that it was quite removed from at least the political events on the mainland. So I went there in March 2003 for 2 weeks with my partner, and we spent the time kind of watching the invasion of Iraq unfold. And it was really intrigued me was going into, you know, not just watching this in cafes on televisions, but going into the countryside and listening to radio, like BBC Arabic, with Socotrans who were following this very closely. And then thinking about Socotran's engagement with the region from a distance, but what all these conflicts happening, you know, in places that are more typically studied, like Egypt or, you know, Iraq and Syria, what they looked like from people so far at the margins of the region. So I was interested in that, but it's during this period that I also learned about this environmental conservation project that was happening on the island. And I heard about Socotrans who had been deported from the island to the Arab Gulf. Now, deported is the word that people were using, but really it was a form of banishment of women who had been accused of witchcraft and then sent on any dhow passing by, and they would end up going to what was then Oman, the Trucial States, and settling there. So I was drawn to these unusual deportation narratives of so-called or alleged or accused witches who'd been deported, and thinking that this is a different way to think about deportation, as well as the fact that I started thinking about a shift because when I did go back to Somaliland in 2004, things were a little bit it was a little bit dangerous to be there at that time period. So between a mix of kind of moving around the area because of different precautions and events that were happening, that's what led me to this field site in Socotra.
Listening to you and reading your book, I couldn't help but to think about the difficulty of such a site, especially given the current pandemic. So drawing from your experience, do you have any advice about conducting field work and researching challenging sites such as Yemen? And do you have insights that you can share with aspiring scholars who want to study similar sites?
Yes, it's, I have not actually really started trying to do field work since the pandemic started. My last besides being in contact with people, but my last field trip was actually in January, just before it broke out, when I went back to Djibouti. But I think because Yemen was already, in 1999, when I first went, I traveled around the entire country on my own and shared taxi, and it seemed that it was very open. And then with each year, and it was in the early 2000s, it was quite possible to do field work there, and there were a number of anthropologists. But by the mid 2000s, it started to become more difficult. And so already in that first project, I was, as I just mentioned, I kind of positioned myself, I kind of moved between Somaliland, Yemen, Socotra. I've now recently, in the past couple of years, I've gone back to Somaliland. So instead of thinking about one particular topic and one particular site, kind of by circumstance, but I think this is something that I would now advise scholars too, is I really was thinking about working within a broader region that would allow me to move from one part of the region to the other region as needed. And so I now see my field, so to speak, of research where the places where I try to ask similar questions being Yemen and the Horn of Africa. And this allows me to go back and forth as necessary. And and in some cases, this means moving between themes. So I started off wanting to work on refugees and did some work on deportation, then went to environmental projects and transformations. Now I'm actually working, have a project on refugees again, but I see this, my next project, more related to forced movement because of climate change, so climate refugees. So these even things that seem like very disparate projects end up coming together. And so I think that, I guess the main takeaway is to build in a kind of flexibility in terms of the research topic and site that allows you, so you may have to make radical shifts at the moment or move from one place or topic to another, but then actually over time, this has actually been, now that I'm going back and working on refugees, Yemeni refugees in the Horn of Africa, I have the benefit of having already spoken to a lot of Somali refugees in Yemen in the early 2000s. So it gives me a longer arc in terms of thinking about this project. So if people do have to abandon something midfield or shift to something because of security developments or now because of the pandemic, hopefully that will end up actually being a benefit because you can fold that work into different projects at a different time that gives you this larger arc or longer angle of working in the field. And I guess, and with that, I suppose, you know, the real key is how, first of all, it's hard to come up with good research questions. And so this is really what we're trying to do, right? What is a good research question, but also how can we ask this question in several kinds of ways and in several kinds of environments? And you know, now one way is obviously by following people as they move to different places. And so a topic like refugees allows for this more easily, but also during the pandemic, we're all learning how to have schooling on Zoom and things like this. So I think we're really going to be learning how to do a lot of our research through Zoom and as well as other social media as well. As an anthropologist, I think that initial ability to be there is very helpful for having connections and contacts with people. So, you know, I feel more confident continuing field work and interviews via Zoom and other ways with people I already had the opportunity to meet in person. And then once those connections are established, then I think it's, you know, it doesn't make so much of a difference about whether I can actually meet them again in person or not. Although that, of course, is always still ideal.
Definitely. Yeah. This is really useful. And I've spoken to some anthropologists in the past, and they told me that they intended initially to work on Saudi Arabia, but it wasn't accessible at the time, so they shifted to Yemen. And now the other way around is happening. So the book consists of 6 chapters with an introduction and a conclusion. In the introduction, I would like to ask you, how does your book contribute to the way we historically and anthropologically approach insularity as a notion and island studies in the Indian Ocean world? Can you introduce Socotra as a case study for approaching these questions?
Yeah, well, you gave a very good introduction to Socotra. I had never known about, as you say, some people may have never heard about this island. I had actually didn't know anything about it until I first went to Yemen. And when I was sitting with some Socotran friends at one point looking at a map, and when you look at a two-dimensional map of the world and see that Socotra is actually right in the middle of this, you know, a typically kind of depicted map with the United States, North America on the left and Asia on the right, then this is a, you know, Socotrans consider themselves very central in the world, their location. And it is actually the second largest island in the Western Indian Ocean, the fifth largest island in the Indian Ocean, Socotra Island. And then, of course, there's these 3 other smaller islands that make up the archipelago. So it is one of the most, it's also incredibly diverse in terms of its endemic flora and also some fauna. More than a third of its plant species are not found anywhere else in the world. And for this reason, it was also recognized as a Natural World Heritage Site in 2008. But even now, Socotra is presented, especially by journalists and travelers, as completely isolated, remote, forgotten, an island that they need to discover. And, you know, and I can understand why during this period when there's very little tourism, people might think that they've discovered this island, but it's been represented this way consistently for decades. And in some cases, when you go back to literature, kind of British travelers in the 19th century, the same kinds of ways of talking about Socotra are still present today. I think in part, this has a lot to do, this sense of Socotra being, this depiction of Socotra being completely isolated and remote, as if also insular, has a lot to do with this seasonal monsoon, during which either it was kind of seasonally secluded until the expansion of the airstrip in 1999, or it's just a difficult time for people to travel there. But it's precise, but what happened during the monsoon period also is that it was a very difficult time for Socotrans because they had to stockpile food before that because dhows could no longer stop at the island and bring food to them. Or they suffered sometimes drought and many periods of famine. So the very fact that Socotrans ended up feeling so secluded during this monsoon period actually underscores how much it was dependent on and tied into a regional food network. That is, far from being these self-dependent, self-reliant, pastoralists on this island who are isolated from the rest of the world. Socotrans were very much dependent on the connections through Dao travel and trade of people from around the Indian Ocean. So especially before actually its kind of more recent integration into the Yemeni nation state. So in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, I mean, if they were they were very dependent on getting maize and from the Horn of Africa and on dates and other foods being brought in from the Arab Gulf and a lot, you know, so, and they were also exporting food products to these regions. So their Socotrans actually have a very long connection, historical connection to the African coast, as well as the Arab Gulf, even more than they did to mainland Yemen for much of that period. And so I think what this example presents to us is what I tried to do in my book, at least, is really focus on these connectivities. So I was very interested in how Socotrans thought of themselves as being connected to a place like the United Arab Emirates. And this was before I moved to the UAE myself. In fact, I was only hearing about, I'd never been to the UAE, and I was only hearing about the UAE through Socotrans, who sometimes when they were singing lullabies to their children going to sleep, they would sing about the cars being brought to them from Ras Al Khaimah, for instance. And it was very, the UAE was very present in the way that Socotrans talked about their relatives being there and in terms of the kind of aid and assistance they got from these relatives. And the first time I went to the UAE, to Abu Dhabi, where I ended up, and I mentioned this because I'm now located in Abu Dhabi, not currently, but normally, because I teach for New York University in Abu Dhabi. The first time I went was in 2005 to actually trace down one of the Socotrans who had been accused of witchcraft and therefore left the island and ended up there. So Socotrans had, my book really tries to focus on these connections to the broader Arab Gulf. And then also, think about the historical connections to East Africa. Also to point out that an island like Socotra, and I'm sure, you know, many other islands, is all these other islands in the Indian Ocean, can be somewhat secluded or remote in a seasonal or even in a cyclical sense, or even today during periods of war, but they're never insular. They're never disconnected. I mean, this is really kind of writing against this message that you get from journalistic and traveler accounts of this island that had been untouched by any outside influences or as if untouched by modernity in general.
Mm-hmm. That takes us to the question you posed in the introduction, which is how heritage, a nominally conservative endeavor, and revolution, a nominally transformative endeavor, can be connected. How does the Socotri case connect these two endeavors?
So I started documenting when I started my fieldwork there in 2004 when I was living there. And I was documenting a lot of conservation efforts, really between 2004 and 2010, that were both in terms of the way a series of projects tried to conserve Socotra's natural heritage, that is the environment, but also local Socotran efforts to conserve their cultural heritage. And at that time, it was very much about conservation and in a somewhat conservative sense. So Socotrans were talking, there were a lot of debates that they were engaged in terms of what should and should not be included in their cultural heritage and who would have the authority to produce that. That is, would it be, is heritage something that is defined by international experts? Because there were a lot of researchers and experts who would come to the island. Is it defined by the state, by bureaucrats? Can the Socotran Islanders define it and author their heritage? But then or is it the emigrants from the people in the diaspora? And if it is the Islanders, then is heritage just what the Socotran Bedouin pastoralist Arabs think it is? Or to what degree are the African Socotrans included in this? This was a lot of this was being debated in kind of questions about what should and should not be included in their heritage. How do you account for what we today call negative heritage, like the fact that Sukhutrans had believed in witchcraft and had banished witches, or that they had worked through kind of sorcerers and witch doctors because there were no doctors at the time on the island. So it was a little, you know, people are trying to make sense of this heritage, but it was a little bit more conservative in its outlook. At the same time, I saw that it was giving Sukhutrans kind of a sense of empowerment, because one of the main things is that I was hearing from a lot of Sukhutrans is they'd grown up ashamed to speak their language. And so once Sukhutri, which is a Semitic language, it's its own language, different from Arabic, distinct from Arabic. And when they started thinking about their language as heritage and thinking about heritage as something that had to be preserved and promoted and celebrated, then they also started thinking about a right to their language. And this gave them a sense of empowerment. And so over the years, I saw this promotion and mobilizing of heritage becoming more empowering, and then dovetailing with the demonstrations at the time of the revolution, which also brought Sukhutrans, like Yemenis, like Egyptians and Syrians, and you know, many, many people across the around the Arab world, to the streets with a new sense of being able to speak out and to make demands upon the state. And so so the way I connect these, or the way the Sukhutra case connects these, actually what I should say is it was connected for me by one of my main interlocutors, who was organizing poetry festivals and political protests in the same day at the same time. And when I asked him about these different events that he was doing, he's the one who said, well, they're all part of the same work, right? So becoming, mobilizing one's heritage to actually feel proud of one's identity and to be able to feel that one can determine one's identity became part of that sense of taking to the streets and actually trying to demand and effect change. And so I guess they were really connected through the sense of empowerment that people got from both aspects. And in that sense, the heritage work became, as I argue later on, and I could talk about a little bit later, it became in that sense revolutionary, because it allowed Sukhutrans to think of themselves in new ways.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
How did you pursue this connection? What were some of the sources you draw on and methodologies you deployed in researching and writing Islands of Heritage?
Yeah, I started. So my first, I started with pretty much conventional anthropological fieldwork. So I lived on the island from 2000, like fall 2004 to beginning 2006, and a lot of this was kind of very. It included participant observation, hanging out with people, and taking part in daily activities. Like I taught English to seventh graders in the school. I would spend a lot of time in the campsite, kind of behind the scenes. So in the kitchen, watching Sukhutrans interact with tourists who were new to the area there. I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, I was living in a protected area. All of Sukhutra had become a protected area, but it had nature sanctuaries and also called protected areas within it. So I was living in a newly established protected area on the island. And so I was taking part in these daily activities and chores, but also anytime as people from the environmental conservation projects would come to the protected area to teach the Socotrans about the environment. I was there during all of these meetings and meetings of the local association for conservation and development. I also did unstructured interviews with my neighbors and other people living in the area, collected life histories. And that's probably where I would have stopped had I not realized at one point that, I had at one point I was hearing about a poetry cycle or debate that was happening. And there had been a long 45 minute oral poem that had been sent from Oman to Socotra by cassette tape that had been so incendiary that it caused a fight in the streets of Hadibo. And then, and this was a poet who lived in Oman, a Socotran poet. And then poets on the island responded through poetry that they also sent back by cassette tape. So there were these poems being sent back and forth that were also basically a debate about what to do about negative aspects of the past. And in this particular case, it was about the fact that the Sultan's family had been executed in 1974, and people are trying to understand how to commemorate or reconcile this. And so I sat down with some Socotran poets and they helped me translate it because I was operating primarily in Arabic. So they helped me translate from Socotri to Arabic and then I translated into English. And I realized that all this time I'd been trying to understand what people were thinking about these transformations on the island, not just in terms of this new environmental conservation project that was happening, but the various transformations the island had gone through from a sultanate to a socialist, being governed as a military enclave by the socialist state of South Yemen, to now being part of the Unified Republic of Yemen and now opening up to tourism. People were timid to talk about their views about these transformations, but not in poetry. So I felt that a lot of the political debates, or I came to understand that a lot of the political debates were happening in poetry and that I had to take that into account as well. So I began sitting with friends and they translated a lot of poetry for me so that I could follow some of these debates. I also then studied the project documents of a successive, there were four different integrated conservation development projects that operate on the island starting in 1997, going through 2013, and then actually a little bit later. So I studied those. And then I left the island after, I was no longer living there after 2006, but I continued to go back and visit almost annually until 2013 was my last visit there. And so I kept, having these shorter periods of field work. I also met with Socotrans after that in Bahrain, Oman, in Abu Dhabi, in Europe. And then what I added to that was also studying the colonial archives. So Socotra had been a British protectorate from the 1880s to 1967. The British occupied Socotra during World War II. So there's rich record of all the Dhow traffic, the grain markets, the so-called deportations. The British the officers took note of all of these things, which kind of gave me a data to supplement the oral histories that I was collecting from the Socotrans. So my book draws on this, my observations being there, but also Socotrans observation debates that are occurring through poetry, as well as this historical material to supplement people's memories of the past.
Mm-hmm. As somebody who works on environmental history, I really appreciated your engagement with questions related to the environment in this book. So in the introduction, you have an interesting take on the nature-cultural divide and the way we study heritage making. Can you share some of that?
Yeah. Well, so there are a number of scholars have rightly critiqued this idea that there's something like natural heritage and cultural heritage, or even the distinction between tangible and intangible. And this goes into broader scholarly academic critiques of the divisions between humans and animals and things, right? And so as a scholar, as an academic, I think that I have no critique of their critique. I think that there's really a false binary between things like natural heritage and cultural heritage. However, I also think it's easy for us to kind of think theoretically about the fact that, we as scholars, we always like to disturb binaries and to undo them and to kind of claim that these are the abstract distinctions. But on the ground, as heritage is produced and defended, in practice, these separations continue to exist. And so we need to ask ourselves, who is making the claims for what counts as heritage and to what ends? So heritage making is inherently a political process. And for someone like me to say, well, really, you know, there's no, you know, we shouldn't have these distinctions between natural and cultural heritage. We shouldn't have natural world heritage sites and cultural world heritage sites. And in fact, UNESCO has also recognized that. And so you now have something, there's actually a category for mixed sites that have elements of natural heritage and cultural heritage. But for people to, this kind of erasure that makes a lot of sense theoretically can actually, we have to think about the effects of that on the ground. So in the case of Sukhutra, Sukhutrans were actually trying to insist that there was something, they did have a cultural heritage, and that is something that they, because it was their language that very few non-Sukhutrans speak, and their poetry, that this is something that they had the right to define, to author, to promote, to present. And in a way, as kind of a defense of what a kind of a green imperialism of or a global environmentalism. So what would happen on the island, it would be very easy for people to come in and say, you know, this natural heritage, your environment, your biodiversity is so important. It's one of the most important botanical diversity of the world, of the island groups, one of the most important island groups. And it's the Galapagos of the Indian Ocean. And therefore, we are going to come in and tell you how to conserve this and how to protect this and why this is important for the world. And so there is a bit of a colonial imperialistic move in that, where Sukhutrans are then not part of that process. And so for them, it was quite important to say, okay, you know, so instead of saying, look, and with that, we'll incorporate your cultural heritage too. And so we'll say that all of this heritage really belongs to all of humanity and it's important for everybody. But then who are the, in that kind of move, who are the people who become the experts? It ends up being people with degrees or who are being, consultants for large, for UN programs. And so in that sense, being able to have these distinctions on the ground of, well, no, wait, this is our cultural heritage, and this is something that we want to have authority over, can be a very necessary and productive defense. And so as much as theoretically, I would agree that absolutely that, that these binaries of nature and culture are problematic, we really have to be attentive to the power claims that are occurring when people, the power differentials that are happening when people make these claims.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, biodiversity also in many cases coexists with cultural diversity. And Sukhutra is such a case where you have both of them at the same time, which is very interesting. In chapter one, Hospitality in Unsettling Times, you make a familiar cultural value that we all know if we work on Arabia, I think, hospitality, to make it unfamiliar in a very interesting way. So in this chapter, you ask how the unprecedented opening of Sukhutra gave rise to a crisis of hospitality, a long-held cultural value. So can you tell us about the tension between this value and the changes that were brought by the nation state and the transformation from, as you said, militarized enclave to a national protected area?
Yes. Hospitality. There's been so much written about hospitality, especially, for people working in the Arab world, the Middle East. But and it's something that Sukhutrin's talked about a lot. And so this is kind of what, you know, as an anthropologist, you go somewhere thinking you're going to work on one thing, and then you realize, okay, well, what are people actually talking about? And so, but they were the people, my hosts, for instance, were talking a lot about hospitality, very possibly because they were given, you know, they were not really, they were asked, gently. I don't know how much they felt that they could say no, but they were suddenly called upon to host me for the year. But they, Sukhutrin's really valued karama, hospitality, generosity, and would tell stories again and again, these kind of mythical, archetypical stories of the person who gave away all that he had. And of course, it was almost always men in this case. And the tensions of the, if you had unlimited hospitality, that it actually reduces the ability of the person to be a good host. Because if you give away everything that you have, then you have nothing left to give, and then you can no longer be a host. And so there's this paradox of hospitality that is, of course, has also been well theorized by Jacques Derrida, and you can read Derrida and think a lot about the paradox of the law of hospitality versus the laws of hospitality, or as Andrew Shryock writes about in his work in Jordan, you can also hear very much the same kind of debates about, you know, questions about this paradox happening from people who are engaged in this, who hold this up as this ideal for themselves, being, having unlimited hospitality and being very generous hosts. So during, what happened was I was hearing a lot of stories about people who were so generous that they would give and give and give. And in part, it's because also as a pastoralist society, people would not, you know, their meals were somewhat limited to the produce of livestock, so milk and some grains and ghee. And people would only really eat meat when they would slaughter some of their livestock if there was a guest coming by. So hospitality was also very significant, because that was a time that people would actually kind of feel that they really had a full meal. So during, it was preserved for times of weddings, or also times when you had important guests coming through. Now, during the socialist period, the island, it was harder for people from outside the island. So the relatives who had gone abroad to visit, very few were able to return. And but then in the late 1990s, early 2000s, this is when the island opened up, so to speak, to tourism, but also to guests coming back, to relatives coming back from the Gulf to visit. And so, in fact, the Sukhutrins found themselves with suddenly having too many guests and too many people to host. And so living up to their ideals of generosity and hospitality became very taxing, because, you know, it's one thing to think that if any stranger comes to your house, you're going to run out and slaughter a goat for them, when that only happens every couple of months or a few times a year. And it's another thing to try and live up to that when you suddenly have visitors from abroad or tourists coming by again and again and again. And so Sukhutrins felt that they could no longer afford to be this kind of consummate host. But if they were not living up to these ideals, then who were they, or who had they become? So this is where this value of hospitality became kind of a crisis of, you know, who are we now if in fact we are not as generous? We have more, but we are less generous. And so what does that mean for us in terms of our own conception of ourselves?
Mm-hmm. And that takes us to the second chapter, Hungering for the State. In this chapter, you have very interesting conceptualization of the island's history as that one governed by, through food, famine, and fear. If you can elaborate more on these three connections.
Yeah, I was interested in Sikkhija's transformation to a World Heritage Site. And so to think about that, I also wanted to look back at other transformations that had happened. So I interviewed a lot of, spoke to a lot of elderly Sikkhutrans who had lived through these four distinctive states. So people who were in their 50s and 60s had lived during the period of the Sultanate until 1967, which had also been a British protectorate. They had experienced the socialist People's Democratic Republic of Yemen. They were now, of course, part of the Unified Republic of Yemen, and were now experiencing kind of a, what at the time seemed like a de facto state of a new UN-supported environmental conservation project. And each of these, but all of these states, so as different as they were from a sultanate to a socialist state to a more kind of neo-patrimonial state to environmental protections, they had seemed so different, but there was this one thread that ran through people's experience of all of them. And in part, it was because every one of these states was experienced as a kind of a stranger. So there were always these stories of arrival of this state. When the sultans were here, even the sultans were seen as having come from outside, from Mahra. So when the sultans were there, and then the British arrived, and then the socialists arrived, and then the, you know, so the state was constantly seeming to arrive in these different guises, somewhat, you know, at times even as strangers. And so when people talked about the sultans and that period, they spoke a lot about what they remembered was how that they were afraid of the sultans, because the sultans would travel through the island to mete out punishment. So if the sultan was coming to visit you in the countryside, it was often to, for instance, to amputate someone's arm if there had been theft or things like that. So people, it was, you know, they were afraid of the sultans. The sultans taxed people, a kind of a 10% tax on their food and livestock. But also because of hospitality and generosity and power, when the sultans arrived, that was a time that you would have a lavish feast for them. So So their memories of the sultanate period were, and the number of Sikkhutrans had lived through several quite severe famines. So they thought about this time of food shortage and famine, but then also, and in these periods of shortage of food shortage and famine, they could then go, and at least some of them could go to the sultan's house and be fed by the sultan instead. So there was kind of a reciprocity of expectations that, of course, when the sultan travels throughout the island, they would put on a lavish feast. And then when there was no food left, they would try to, you know, be fed by the sultan. So the relationship with the sultans were mediated through food, but also fear. So then, and that's, you know, people remember the sultanate period in that way. But then when they talked about the socialist period, people would also talk a lot about food and fear. And this was because the socialists had introduced subsidized imported food. So this was a time when Sikkhutrans were first started eating things like rice and drinking tea and sugar. And so they were getting more foods, but it was also very much their relationship to these foods were very mediated through the state. And they were afraid of anytime a government official would come into the Badi, into the countryside, because oftentimes they were coming to take the children to, like there was a school for nomadic Bedouin, and Sikkhutrans talk about being afraid that they were going to be kidnapped to go to school, that their kids were going to be kidnapped. So that was one way of talking about about the socialists in terms of food and fear. But then even in the unity era, when Sikkhutra became more integrated into unified Republic of Yemen, there is another concern of kind of the concern with food, because a lot of the food subsidies were removed, and Sikkhutrans were experiencing more price gouging. The state also developed a whole series of asphalt and paved roads throughout the island, and these roads were a way, you know, all this was supposed to bring change and development. And in many cases, they were very helpful. The roads would allow Sikkhutrans to go more easily to the hospital, of course, more quickly. But in one poem, one of the clever goats from the Badia, from the countryside, points out that Roads, of course, lead to markets, and markets are a place or a venue for slaughter. So there was a kind of a fear of what all these developments would bring and what these literally these inroads and these new roads would bring. So in all of these transformations between these various different states, I found that there was this one unifying thread, which was that each interaction with the different state was mediated by food, but marked by fear and threatened by either a literal famine or food insecurity, or a more metaphorical kind of slaughter, that is opening to new markets and the threats that come with that.
Mm-hmm. I found really chapter 3 and chapter 4 of interest to environmental studies, I would say. And the literature you engage with and the context you present the case in resembles in many cases in East Africa, imposing wilderness, or in South Asia as well. So in chapter 3, when the environment arrived, in chapter 4, arrested development, you analyze the development and conservation projects that they were brought between 1996 and 2013, which resulted in the island inscription as a UNESCO Natural World Heritage Site. In your assessment, why the environment as a project and a concept failed to mobilize Socotra's pastoral community so dependent on their natural surroundings, and how the politicization of the environment, let's say, polarized the community?
Socotrans, I call the chapter When the Environment Arrived. And what I mean by that is Socotrans referred to, there are a series of integrated conservation development projects, but all of them are referred to Socotrans as the Mashru Albiya, so the environmental project. And for short, they would call them Albiya, the environment. And so people would talk about, say things like when the environment arrived, meaning when these projects arrived on the island. But it became clear to me that they were also talking about this concept of the environment, because apparently Socotra doesn't actually have a word for the environment in the Socotra language. So here you have pastoralists who are very dependent on their climate and the grasses, the grazing, their animals, the trees. Socotrans had depended on trees for medicinal reasons. And so they're very attuned to the natural world around them, but didn't really objectify it as such, as this one thing that we in English call the environment. Just a small example of this is I was kind of driving. And so the environment was introduced as, so the Socotrans had to be taught about the environment, even though this is something that they had long lived with, in a way that was somewhat new, but also objectified and commodified and therefore a little bit alienated. So people would, in these training sessions, pastoralists would be taught things like, this environment is important because you have all these plants that don't occur anywhere else in the world. And you have birds that are endemic, that are not present anywhere else in the world. And you are like the Galapagos of the Indian Ocean, which earns X amount in terms of tourism. And so you could earn that much money too. So they were being taught to think of their environment in terms of being valuable relative to other places, but also for kind of the purpose of monetization and capitalism, in a way that was new and a little bit alien to them. And then also seeing the environment therefore as something which was of interest to tourists and able to be commodified. So I don't mention this in the book, but I was driving along one day with some friends in a car, and somebody threw a Pepsi can out of the window. And I said, "Oh, wait, the Bia, the environment." And the passenger said, "Well, but this isn't the environment. This is just a kind of an oasis that's a little bit dirty. This is where people had regularly thrown trash. This is not the environment." And what he meant by that is this is not the picturesque places where the tourists come to see the dragon's blood trees or to take photographs. So in that messaging of this concept of the environment, the message that they were getting was the environment is that which can be capitalized or that which must be protected because people outside care about it or find it interesting or important. And so this was alienating, but also they didn't see themselves so much reflected in the projects. So the projects employed a few Sukhutrans, but primarily there were international scientists, experts, or Yemenis from the mainland. They didn't really utilize Sukhutri language. So again, all these concepts, I mean, like protected area, environment, these were all Arabic terms. So they were, and it was conservationists who were coming in and doing these studies and then telling Sukhutrans, for instance, why certain things were, certain species were valuable, endemic, important, but without really being able to put to use Sukhutri traditional ecological knowledge or practices, not using Sukhutri language, and also really not using even the language of Islam. So, you know, it could have gone both ways. People could have actually tried to shore up, to start with the base of Sukhutri practice and knowledge, and to try and to encourage these kind of traditional ecological practices. Or they could have talked a little bit more about ways of thinking about the environment in a religious sense. But both of these were kind of left to the side for a more scientific approach that seemed very alien on the one hand, or commodified on the other.
Mm-hmm. I found that really interesting that the scientific, let's say, discourse did not really translate well in the society, and that led maybe to the politicization of the situation. Now we move to the cultural part of this equation. In chapter 5, Reorienting Heritage, I find the chapter very interesting. If you can briefly sketch the formation of the Sokotran diaspora and the Arab Gulf state that you mentioned earlier, and how it, as you say, sought to denature and reorient Sokotran heritage by shifting the focus from nature to culture, from Sokotran autochthony to Arab descent, from Indian Ocean hybridity to genealogical purity, and from the Yemeni nation to the transnational Gulf.
Yeah, that's quite a sentence. I won't go through all of that because it's in the book. But I mentioned earlier this migration connection. I mean, according to the last official census in Yemen, which was taken in 2004, about 10% of Sukhutrans, the last census had 43,000 Sukhutrans living on the island. And then if that's true, then more than 10% would have been living abroad in Oman, UAE, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia. So it's actually quite a significant percentage of Sukhutrans who live in the Arab Gulf states. And this occurred in my book. I talk about different ways of these migrations. Primarily, much of this was economic. So you had a lot of men who were involved in working as seasonal labor migrants on pearling vessels, or going, originally or later going to work as unskilled labor migrants in the Gulf after, in a new kind of petro economies. And in fact, British officers at the time often commented on the shortage of labor for their own projects because there were so many Sukhutrans at sea or working abroad. And then I also mentioned some of the women who had been deported or banished as witches who would find their way to or then the Trucial States and marry into these Sukhutran communities living in the Gulf. And then you also had a number of Sukhutrans fleeing the island in the late 60s, early 70s, because they were afraid of the socialist government. So hundreds of Sukhutrans left the island at that time and then were not able to go back until after the Yemeni civil war in 1994, but really after 1999, when it was possible to fly there more easily. And then so that led to a new kind of connections between the diaspora and the islanders, which is you had, say, brothers who were living, one in Sukhutra, one in Oman, for instance, And their children, the cousins, had never met each other until they were young adults with this new opening of the island. And then would there was a lot of connection again through marriage. So a lot of the women on the island would marry their cousins, their relatives or family friends living in the Gulf. So Socotrans really relied on these connections for first remittances, for aid, for assistance, for food assistance throughout the years. But it also then, and so the diaspora has a really privileged place in Socotra because they're so important for the economic security of people in Socotra. But they also then were very invested, not just economically, but also ideologically, in trying to define and determine these debates around Socotran heritage, identity, culture, and the past. And one thing to think about is this diaspora, because they had not been able to return from the 70s to the late 1990s, had actually not lived during, had not experienced the socialist state and had not experienced really the benefits of it. That is, when public schooling, which was compulsory, subsidized foods, better medical care. And so the older members of the diaspora tended to be quite nostalgic for the Sultanate period, which was the Socotra they had known when they had left. And whereas the people on the island had moved on from that and had also gone through this different kind of system and new ways of thinking about themselves. And so that's where there was really a kind of a tension developing between the people in the diaspora who felt that that they wanted to have more input into they wanted to their story of what Socotra was a bit more conservative and nostalgic and more closely linked to the Sultanate period than was the identifications of Socotrans who had stayed on the island during all of that period. So that led to, quite some tension, especially around issues about, I mentioned earlier about how to deal with the fact of the Sultan's kins and family members having been executed, which some of the diasporic members of the diaspora still felt were necessary to deal with, and people on the island wanted to move on from that.
Mm-hmm. And you pursue these tensions in the last chapter, Heritage in the Time of Revolution. So in this period, how did the islanders mobilize cultural heritage during the Yemeni Revolution? And what are some of the tensions between their cultural linguistic politics and that of the Yemeni nation state, given that it's quite, rich when it comes to linguistic minorities, religious, even racial. So how do you see these tensions playing out during these years?
So I said earlier that Socotrans started promoting their heritage, mobilizing it. They were very influenced by what was happening in the Gulf in terms of heritage production and preservation. So in Abu Dhabi, you had the Millions Poet, which was a very popular television show, bringing in Nabati poets from all around the region to perform poetry in terms of a contest. And so again, it was members of the Socotran diaspora who'd been watching this and said to people on the island, why don't you do the same thing and we'll send money to help fund this. So Socotrans began these quite involved 5 to 10 day long poetry contests in 2008 on the island that continued every year until 2012. And this was a way for them to, and it was a very new kind of way of presenting poetry. So instead of just outside at a wedding or at a gathering of people for a social event, poetry was staged and became part of a performance and a contest. And again, this also had the effect of making people feel The Sukhutrins who had grown up being told that it was shameful to speak Sukhutri, that because it was not Arabic, it was not the language that's enshrined in the Yemeni constitution or the language of the Quran. They felt that this was something in official sites that they were not even allowed to speak Sukhutri. So they had grown up with this one understanding, and then suddenly were performing Sukhutri language poetry on stage, and people were earning prizes for this. That shift made them, you know, think about their own linguistic diversity. And as you mentioned, linguistic diversity and cultural diversity and environmental diversity are very much linked. And so they were able to think, you know, we have this environmental diversity, but we also have linguistic and ethnic. We are linguistic and ethnic minorities, but that's not something to be ashamed of. This is something that we should be able to celebrate. And so that period, as I used the word empowerment before, that gave people this new sense of pride in their own diversity. And then what was quite amazing for me to see is that that translated into actual political action, which then was stalled because everything that's happened since. But during the National Dialogue Conference that happened in Yemen in 2013, the Sukhutrins and the Mahris who went and took part in that actually were able to convince the other people taking part in that to include a new article in the draft constitution for a new Yemeni constitution that would recognize, pay special attention to Mahri and the Sukhutri languages as important languages that are part of the Yemeni nation. So within a 10-year span, we had people who'd been ashamed to speak Sukhutri in public to going in and writing, you know, adding an amendment to the constitution that this language, in addition to environment, needed to be protected. And so this is where, as I mentioned earlier, talking about, it wasn't just that people's turn to heritage gave them a sense of empowerment. It really did, revolutionize the way that they thought about themselves as ethnic and linguistic minorities within the state of Yemen during what was, during the revolution, during what was a revolutionary period where people were able to make new claims on the state and to think more broadly about the value of not, the original Yemeni constitution, like many constitutions in Arab states, had stated that Yemen is an Arab state, that Islam is the religion of the state, that Arabic is the language. And so it was an opening for people to think differently about all of the racial, religious, linguistic diversity that actually is present in the Arabian Peninsula. And it was a very hopeful moment. And then unfortunately, the war started. And so, we don't know if people can go back to celebrating and including all of and recognizing all of this diversity in this area. But I think that's what probably needs to happen for people to be able to heal from what's going on today.
Yeah. Listening to you, I think of competing maybe visions for the island. So do you think they are competing visions? And how, in your assessment, these competing visions will contribute to the island's future?
Well, so there are competing. When I finished the book, I was thinking really about the competing visions in terms of heritage. So at that point, already in early 2018, there were these poetry contests were getting new funding from backers in the United Arab Emirates and other places. And so they became a little bit, what had been grassroots heritage production began to look a little bit more like the kind of heritage that you see in the United Arab Emirates, in Abu Dhabi, in Dubai, that is heritage festivals, you can kind of villages and things like that that are a little bit more large scale, a little bit more top down, have more funding, a little bit more of a state narrative. And so that was one way that heritage production could go. That is, it would be taken, you know, it would not be so much done at the individuals who are not with very little funding trying to debate this among themselves, but it would become more of a state project. And then another vision was that you would still have these large-scale conservation projects. So even in 2013, the Global Environment Facility was funding a new conservation and development project on the island that was actually trying to incorporate more Socotri language and to include Socotrans in a way that spoke back to some of these earlier criticisms. So these visions were on the one hand for kind of a more state orchestrated cultural heritage versus projects that were still primarily conservationist and environmental. Because of the war and a lot of NGOs leaving during that time, there was also still a vacuum. And so even with everything that's been going on in Yemen, there are Socotrans working actively on their own to protect their archaeological sites, to record and document their stories, oral histories, their material culture. So, you know, this what we see is that, in fact, when you allow people, when there's a bit of room for people to do the work themselves, then there is a sense of ownership and it can lead to hopeful advances. Now, there's also today, when I completed the book, I had also mentioned that Socotra was the one area of Yemen that had been relatively unscathed from the war, as there hadn't been any fighting there, but it had been very much affected by cyclones that had ripped through the island. And that unfortunately has changed since the publication of the book. So now there have been just in the past couple of weeks, there have been clashes between supporters of the Southern Transitional Council or the Army of the Southern Transitional Council and the Hadi government. And so you now have also very different competing political visions. That is, questions about whether Socotra will become an independent authority, whether it'll become part of a secessionist South Yemen. Some people might, few people want full autonomy. I think Socotrans are, but they are divided about what their future will look like in terms of the new Yemen to emerge. And unfortunately, this is actually, I think this is probably what would bother my Socotran interlocutors the most, which is that the fabric of their society is being torn apart by this political fighting as well.
That's really unfortunate, and we will keep an eye on this recent development. The book is very well written and organized and beautifully illustrated, and I would like to share some of that with the listeners. If you can, please read a passage from the book.
Okay, well, thank you. I've spoken for a long time, so I'm going to select what I hope is a somewhat short passage. And I wanted to give something that had that included the voice of one of my main interlocutors, and his name is Fahid. So, given my interlocutor's evaluation of heritage as a scarce resource, a resource depleted by modernization, extracted by foreigners, and exploited by the diaspora, it is not surprising that the Socotri Society for Heritage and History also sought to stake its claim to it. However, cognizant of the damage that the already disparate projects could inflict, Fahid argued for a more coordinated response. When I ran into him a few weeks later at the Socotra Conservation Development Project office, where he was preparing a presentation on the role of the society, he took up the metaphor of dismemberment again. This time, it was heritage itself that was being torn asunder. "Heritage is like a buried body that everyone's trying to revive," he told me, "but they're all pulling at different pieces. One is pulling at the ear, saying that this is the most important part. The other is pulling at the leg. What's going to happen in the end is that each person will dig up a part of the body with a part here and another part there, but they won't be able to reassemble it. Like Al-Farazdak's slaughtered camel, Sekutra's cadaverous heritage was being cleaved apart by the many poets and experts competing for the choicest piece. Implicit in Fehid's comments is a nostalgia for a once magnificent corpus and the desire for a sovereign society to reinvigorate it in full. But for all his enthusiasm for reassembling the body, there are pieces, impurities, that even the Secretary General of the Sekutra Society for Heritage and History would prefer to leave behind. The Society's conception of Sekutra's heritage excluded two forms of cultural practice in particular, unorthodox beliefs and customs, consigned to the ignorant past, and African dance and music, relegated to the ignoble other.
Beautiful. This is really a beautiful analogy also for the situation. Well, Natalie, I really enjoyed this conversation, but we've taken a lot of your time. And I would like to ask you about your current projects or what you hope to work on.
Well, yeah, so I mentioned I'm now working on, I'm back to working on refugees, which is what I first thought I was going to do in early 2000. And so I am writing about the refugees from Yemen who've made their way to the Horn of Africa. I started in Somaliland, but have now focusing primarily in Djibouti. And that's because in northern Djibouti, in a town called Obok, there are actually two camps side by side. There is the UNHCR camp for refugees from Yemen across the street from a center for African migrants, primarily Ethiopians, who are heading until the pandemic, which has now stopped this. But even as recently as January, we're still walking daily across Djibouti, crossing the Red Sea, and heading to Yemen to go find work in Saudi Arabia. So I have been very interested in the encounters in this region between the African migrants going to Yemen and what are actually a lot of African Yemeni refugees having come from Yemen, which raises a bunch of questions about the distinctions that we make between migrants and refugees and also Africans and Arabs in this interstitial setting. So this is what I'm hoping to write this year. And as you asked earlier on, I'll have to find a way to continue the field work in light of travel restrictions, but also now very much thinking about how the pandemic is affecting people who are, you know, living in this very, very difficult situation, and feel that they're either forced to move or that they are stuck in an untenable situation.
This is very pressing, and you are one brave anthropologist to keep taking on these challenging projects. We will be looking forward to this project, and thank you so much for giving us the time to learn about your book today.
And thank you so much, Ahmed.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to today's episode in which we explored Islands of Heritage, Conservation and Transformation in Yemen, published by Stanford University Press in 2018. This is your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.